Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the principal in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Garrett Gibson, a principal at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. As we turn to spring, Garrick and I wanted to have a podcast episode focused on industry news and other information that came out over the first part of the year. So Garrick and I are going to jump right in sharing this information. The biggest piece of legislation on everyone's mind is the 21st Century Road to Housing Act, which passed by an overwhelming majority in the Senate with an 89-10 vote. This reflects the bipartisan support of housing regulatory reforms, which have been long supported by the affordable housing industry. Key provisions of this bill passed in the Senate include, number one, lifting the rental assistance demonstration cap for public housing authorities looking to convert their public housing units. Number two, increasing the public welfare investment, or PWI, cap from 15% to 20%. And you might be asking, why is that important? This is a longstanding LIHTC priority that could expand tax credit equity investment by banks nearing their current limit. We all know here in 2026 is a little bit of an unusual year with kind of a supply-demand issue causing credit pricing to drop. Number three, streaming NEPA reviews for small and infill housing projects. Number four, prohibiting institutional investors from purchasing single-family homes. And number five, reforming the home program, although not addressing the Build America, Buy America, or BABA requirements. This legislation now awaits House action. With, of course, a lot going on internationally as we record this podcast in April, House leadership has indicated a preference for convening a conference committee in order to resolve the differences between the House and Senate approaches, with bigger differences around private equity and cryptocurrency provisions. Pursuing the conference committee approach could significantly delay the bill, meaning it may not get done in this current Congress. Now I turn over to Garrick for some other updates. Garrick?
Thanks, Don. So in current events, we have President Trump's issued two executive orders around producing affordable housing. The executive orders direct several federal agencies to reduce regulatory barriers to building homes. Example of these barriers include environmental reviews, energy and water use requirements, residential building codes, development density, Chattel lending for manufactured housing, and other rules that constrain residential development and impede housing affordability. One part of this executive order we find interesting is the secretaries of the Treasury and HUD are to jointly evaluate administration actions to align programs and incentives with the Opportunity Zone tax incentive to expand single-family home construction in Opportunity Zones and assess opportunities to coordinate the OZ incentive with the new market tax credit to promote single-family home construction. So that's pretty interesting. The other executive order seeks to make it easier for Americans to purchase homes by directing federal agencies to make a series of regulatory changes the administration believes will reduce unnecessary costs and increase lender participation in mortgage lending and servicing. So the various agencies included in this area are the FHFA and the federal banking regulators look at the federal home loan bank programs and the Federal Housing Administration, USDA, and the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs looking at regulations like including appraisal standards and things like that.
Very good. I'll jump in again. In other news, HUD published the fiscal year 2026 operating cost adjustment factors, which you otherwise known as OCAF, released that here in February of 2026. OCAFs, of course, are used as an inflation adjustment in renewing HAP contracts for PBRA and as an allowable method of rent adjustment for project-based vouchers. Typically, these are published around October of any given year, so it is late this year. The nationwide OCAF adjustment is 5.1%, which is on the high side historically. How does that get split up, or what's that look like across the states? Four states had OCAFs in the 3% to 4% range, and many states, the majority of states, fell within the 4% to 5% increase, with highs overall in the 50 states of 9.8% in Louisiana, and 8.2% in Florida. So very high OCAF adjustments in those two states. Again, you can look up what that OCAF adjustment might be for planning and budgeting purposes. Garrick?
Yeah, Don, and also in news regarding the Radford PRAC program, which is a HUD 202 PRAC projects, that's what it's for. So in the recently passed appropriations bill, Congress provided an additional $4 million in funding to support preservation rent increases for those RAD and PRAC conversions. So there's about $6 million in PRA funding remaining from 2022 and 2023 appropriations. This $6 million will sunset in September of 2026. So any owner that can submit a RAD and PRAC conversion plan by May 29, 2026 will have their preservation rent increases locked in. So owners that need additional time to submit a conversion plan can submit a request for those preservation rent increases and will be placed on a waiting list. So first come, first served. So when the conversion plan is submitted, those preservation rent increases will be reserved. And according to RAD, conversion plans submitted by spring 2027 have a high likelihood of receiving those preservation rent increases.
Very good. That was some good news to see. A lot of people working on RAD for PRACs. Again, if you submit it by May 29th, which is coming up real soon now, you'll actually be locked in. But again, that additional dollars are big. You have projects in process and can't quite meet the May 2026 deadline. Regarding research and reports, we want to cover three recent reports issued that show how smart investments in resident saving mechanisms and services on site where low-income families live can deliver a wide range of benefits that bolster their prospects and those of the properties as well. And that just seems like common sense, but we now have some kind of detailed research and papers supporting that information. The first paper, entitled Building Financial Assets for Residents in LIHTC Communities, so again, the paper, Building Financial Assets for Residents in LIHTC Communities, lays out six different structures and ideas for helping residents of LIHTC finance properties build household savings of $2,000 to $6,000 over 5 years. Several of the ideas include rent rebates, annual bonuses, and capitalized reserves. The paper encourages state housing finance agencies to encourage this type of activity as innovative and maybe getting points for such activity. The other two papers that we'll reference touch on financial education, health, and employee assistance and other on-site resources for low-income renters. One of these reports, entitled The Impact of Resident Services on Property Financial Performance, finds that buildings offer resident services generate 26% higher net operating income, or about $1,200 per apartment, than those that do not. The other report, The Case for Resident Services, reports that owners associate services with greater stability, financial resilience, and resident health outcomes. With a lot of effort and discussion is new financing concepts. This research is significant in helping the operating efficiencies of those affordable properties. So very excited. I think we're going to try and dig in a couple of these on later podcasts, Garrick. Just ideas around services logically makes sense. We have services supporting the residents. Not only is obviously help with health outcomes and achievements of the residents, but overall stability and cash flows of the properties.
Yeah, I think it'll be definitely interesting to cover a wide variety of those specific topics because we haven't done it in a while, and I think we're due. I also wanted to mention, Don, that there was also another report that we always kind of refer to in a wide variety of capacities with the things that we do here at Baker Tilly was the Harvard University Joint Center for Housing Studies, America's Rental Housing 2026 report. So this report actually shows the number of cost burden renter households. It showed that it reached another record high in 2024, with nearly half of renters spending more than 30% of their income on housing. The report also highlights slowing multifamily construction and a growing need to reinvest in the nation's aging rental stock, and increasing pressure on state and local governments to address housing needs as federal resources remain limited. So it's similar to what we're constantly hearing, but I think it seems like every time the study comes out, it's just getting more and more exacerbated.
Yeah, absolutely, Garrick. And it's really interesting that focus, we need new units, but kind of A1 is that preservation of existing units and what dollars are going to be available for those and how do we preserve those from going market and so forth. So interesting trends. One of the last items that Garrick and I are kind of watching closely is states working on their upcoming qualified allocation plans for the cycles here in 2026. Across many states we did a survey of, a few consistent themes are emerging. There's a stronger emphasis on deeper income targeting, along with continued focus on preserving existing affordable housing, as Garrick just alluded to with the need in the report, the Harvard study. Again, preserving existing affordable housing rather than relying solely on new construction. I know part of that is also a cost metric. Of course, doing an acquisition rehab deal on a per unit basis is coming in far, far lower than new construction projects. For example, Massachusetts has increased its focus on extremely low-income households and added more defined sustainability requirements, while states like New York continue to prioritize preservation through their allocation frameworks. We're also seeing more integration of resident services. Again, that's consistent with the reports we just referenced, along with expanded expectations around energy efficiency and climate resiliency. And finally, some states are tightening underwriting standards and adding cost containment measures in response to higher construction costs and interest rates. There's one state we're working in that has kind of a special set aside for construction efficient projects, lower costs, and kind of innovation around that. Overall, even small changes in QAP criteria, of course, can have a big impact on which projects are moving forward in any given year. So this is definitely an area developers and owners need to stay on top of as they plan for their upcoming projects. That's it for this episode of The Buzzhouse, where Garrick and I discussed legislation, research, and other activity in affordable housing space in the beginning of 2026. Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrick Gibson.
Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at build@BakerTilly.com. That's build@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzzhouse.